From WBUR Boston, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Al-Qaeda and Yemen in the spotlight as intercepted talk between top terror leaders leads to a lockdown of embassies across the globe. After war in Afghanistan, the killing of bin Laden, years of drone strikes, what's the nature of Al-Qaeda now? What's changed? We'll look at the current threat, the U.S. reaction, the new face of the terror network. This hour on Point, embassies on alert and Al-Qaeda now. You can join us on air or online where the conversation never ends. What do you think? After all these years, is Al-Qaeda still a threat? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is Elise Labatt, foreign affairs reporter for CNN. Elise, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Can you just bring us up to date on what the situation is, what we know about the threat, how we learned of it, how many embassies are locked down, and how long that's likely to last?
Sure. Well, there are a couple of things going on. First of all, the U.S., as we've been talking about, has these intercepts between members of Al-Qaeda and the Arab Peninsula, AQAP, and Al-Qaeda chief Ayman al-Zawahiri. He was talking with Nasser al-Wahashi, the leader of the Yemen-based Al-Qaeda LP, about plans for a major terrorism attack. Now, the attack wasn't very specific, but it did indicate that it was against U.S. facilities and U.S. interests, potentially in the Middle East.
Elise, were the intercepted communications emails, text messages, phone calls, Skype calls?
It seems to be electronic communications. We're not sure whether it was. We know that there was a phone call, but there could have been more. What the U.S. did was take the very unusual step of closing about 22 of its embassies and consulates. The threat did seem, though, to be emanating very much from Yemen, from this Al-Qaeda affiliate based in Yemen. There was a more specific threat against the U.S. facility there. So the U.S. Withdrew. It already had a very small number of personnel there. It evacuated its personnel yesterday. And as the threat refined, it opened a few of the embassies, but now 19 embassies and consulates across the Middle East remain closed through Saturday, and that's in the domain kind of concentrated where AQAP operates.
Now, does that include the island countries, Mauritius and Madagascar, which some people looked at and said, why are they on the list? What's the logic tying them to this?
Well, you know, there are also Al-Qaeda affiliates operating in this area. Some of those remain closed. Some are remaining open. And the U.S. said it's going to continue to open some and close some as they keep getting more information and refine that threat.
And what is the significance of the drone strikes that we've heard about in the last 24 hours or so? Were those in response to the specifics of the threat, or was that ongoing operations that would have happened anyway?
I think that that's ongoing operations. As you know, the U.S. has been upping its drone strikes in Yemen against AQAP operatives for some time. There have been about 5 drone strikes in the last 2 weeks, and they do know that Al-Qaeda has been planning something. This morning even, the Yemenis announced that they thwarted a plot of Al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula to attack some of the ports and the oil pipelines. So there's this constant threat stream about this Al-Qaeda affiliate in the area, and the threats against the U.S. are part of that, but certainly they're much broader.
Do we know anything specifically about the nature, even if we don't know the target, the nature of the attack that was under discussion?
We don't know that much, but we do know that it was specifically, we're talking about two threats now, this wider threat that Al-Qaeda Chief Ayman al-Zawahiri and the leader of the Yemen-based affiliate, Nasser al-Wahashi, were talking about. This is a very broad threat against U.S. facilities, U.S. interests in the region. And then there was a more specific threat against U.S. facilities in Yemen. And there are only 2 facilities in Yemen where the U.S. Works and lives. So there really wasn't that far to go. But the threat was so unspecific, John. It was so kind of vague that the U.S. took this unusual step of closing the embassies. They really didn't know what they were planning. They just knew they were planning a major terror attack.
Elise, do we know whether or not the whatever Americans were in Yemen heeded the instruction of the government to leave the country immediately?
We don't know how many Americans have left Yemen. We know that they're not a lot. There certainly are a number of particularly foreign workers in the oil pipelines and also NGOs. But they have been, over the last year, kind of reducing their presence as the threat in Yemen has grown stronger. We don't know how many American citizens have left, but we do know that there are very few American officials left in the country.
And Elise, before I let you go, let me just ask you about the reaction that you've seen in Washington. Certainly, there's been a lot of commentary in the press about whether or not it was wise to do what the administration did. But do you have reaction that falls along partisan lines? Are the leaderships of the two parties united that this was prudent or not?
I think they think it was a prudent step to close the embassies, because certainly members of Congress have seen some of this intelligence, some of this information, and they know that the threat is very real. I think what we've heard is criticism of the Obama administration, that the Obama administration has talked about al-Qaeda being on the run, that the al-Qaeda core leadership was certainly decimated after the killing of Osama bin Laden, and that put the organization at a disadvantage, and it was on the run. Now we see that some of these affiliates, particularly in Yemen, are the ones that have the most success in attacks against the United States. You remember that underwear bomber, Abdulmutallab, a potential attack against some U.S. cargo planes. Attacks from these affiliates are now becoming more prominent. And in fact, Zawahiri, the head of al-Qaeda core, just promoted this leader of the Yemen-based affiliate, Nasr al-Wahashi, to the number two in the organization. So what congressmen and particularly Republicans are saying is that the Obama administration claims that al-Qaeda on the run, in fact, this really puts a dent in that, John.
Elise Labatt, thanks for joining us from Washington. Elise is a foreign affairs reporter for CNN. We want to bring in now from California, Brian Michael Jenkins. Brian is a long-term terrorism expert. He's a senior advisor to the president of the RAND Corporation. He authored a big report last year, Al-Qaeda in its Third Decade, Irreversible Decline or Imminent Victory. Brian Michael Jenkins, welcome to On Point.
Hello, John.
I want to start by playing for you a clip from President Obama talking on, of all places, The Tonight Show with Jay Leno last night about the threat that caused him to close these two dozen embassies.
It's significant enough that we're taking every precaution. We had already done a lot to bolster embassy security around the world, but especially in the Middle East, North Africa, where the threats tend to be highest. And whenever we see a threat stream that we think is specific enough that we can take some specific precautions within a certain time frame, then we do so. Now, you know, it's a reminder that for all the progress we've made, getting bin Laden, putting al-Qaeda between Afghanistan and Pakistan back on its heels, that you know, this radical violent extremism is still out there.
So, Brian, critique the administration's reaction and how the president explained it just there.
Well, certainly the radicals, the stream of radical violent extremism is still out there. There's no question that as a consequence of the efforts of the United States and others, al-Qaeda's operational capabilities have been degraded. I mean, its training camps have been dispersed. Its central leadership has been decimated as a consequence of unprecedented cooperation among intelligence services and law enforcement organizations worldwide. Its operating environment is a lot more difficult now than it was years ago. At the same time, al-Qaeda has morphed to meet these new circumstances. The al-Qaeda we see today is much more decentralized, much more dependent on its affiliates like al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and others. And its determination hasn't been dented one bit.
Now, does the decentralization that you referred to mean that they're capable of making smaller attacks on the United States, but not the big bang that we saw on 9/11, or not?
Well, that would be, I mean, they haven't been able to carry out a successful, significant attack in the West since 2005, although we have seen acts by homegrown terrorists, as Al-Qaeda has embraced a do-it-yourself strategy, that is, exhorting its followers, wherever they may be in the world, that while it may be difficult for them to reach the training camps in Pakistan or elsewhere, they can carry out actions in their own countries, and we have seen some of that in Europe and less of it in the United States. Whether or not they're still capable of carrying out a significant attack abroad, I think we have to certainly concede that. By the evidence of that is, of course, our response to the most recent threat, where we did shut down these diplomatic facilities. I think Al-Qaeda's PowerPoints, I mean, we know it's on the Pentagon's PowerPoints, I think Al-Qaeda's PowerPoints would give us a completely different assessment of the situation from their perspective.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about embassy shutdown, America on alert, all over an Al-Qaeda threat. We're joined this hour by Brian Michael Jenkins, terrorism expert at the RAND Corporation. Also joining us this hour from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Ambassador Daniel Benjamin, director of the Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth. He served as ambassador-at-large and coordinator for counterterrorism at the State Department from 2009 until last year. Ambassador Benjamin, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And with us from New York is Gregory Johnson. He's an expert on Yemen at Princeton, author of The Last Refuge, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's War in Arabia. Gregory Johnson, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, John.
I want to go back to Brian Michael Jenkins and just button up the issue of the paper that you wrote last year, which we talked about imminent victory or irreversible decline. What did you conclude?
Well, we in the West are accustomed to war being a finite activity, and therefore we're progress-oriented. Our opponents are process-oriented. That is, they see this struggle as having begun centuries ago and continuing until Judgment Day, and so they can, in a sense, withstand a lot of pressure and yet remain determined to go on. There's no question that Al-Qaeda has benefited enormously from the continuing turmoil in North Africa and the Middle East. They have established, or at least insinuated themselves into conflicts in the Sahel and in Africa. They have expanded their activities in the Sinai. They have expanded in Yemen. They are benefiting enormously from the continuing conflict in Syria. And evidence, again, that was provided in this most recent threat, they have survived our mightiest blows, and indeed the central command, although weakened, still survives, 2 years after the death of bin Laden.
Well, if in fact they have a deep pool of potential recruits, is it misleading to think of the organization as being knocked down if it can stand up so quickly with this decentralized structure?
It has shown itself to be extraordinarily resilient and able to attract new recruits, even as its operational capabilities have been reduced. So that leaves us with the daunting task of either stemming the flow of recruits, that is, those who are attracted by this ideology, or find it to their benefit to join with Al-Qaeda, or, on the other hand, if we cannot do that, to continue operations endlessly to ensure that these new recruits cannot assemble themselves into the kinds of formations of organizations that are capable of carrying out significant terrorist attacks.
Ambassador Benjamin, I want to go with you and read you a column that Jeffrey Goldberg, who I'm sure you know, wrote in Bloomberg yesterday, which raised the specter of overreaction. The headline was "Warning to Americans, Be Afraid, Very Afraid." And Jeffrey Goldberg writes, "It seems as if Al-Qaeda has succeeded in terrorizing the United States again, but this time without detonating an ounce of C4. Doesn't strike me as a wise idea to preemptively shutter 21 American embassies across the Middle East and North Africa in response to chatter. What message does this send to citizens of the Middle East who, it is our hope, understand the United States to be a powerful and fearless country dedicated to openness and the defeat of fanaticism?" How do you respond to that?
Well, there's an element of truth in what Jeff says, but I would phrase it a little differently. I think that a lot of the overreaction has actually been in the public and on Capitol Hill. We've been opening and closing embassies in the region with lots of regularity for many, many years. What is remarkable about this case is the number of posts that are involved, and that certainly is attention-catching. But I think that this has been taken as a sign of Al-Qaeda strength in a way that is, I think, out of line with the group's real capabilities. And the post in Yemen, for example, has been under threat for years, and we have been significantly drawn down for much of the last 4 years in Yemen. Yemen is a country with a very weak federal government, weak security forces, and we've faced a number of challenges. In fact, the very beginning of U.S.-Yemeni cooperation in recent times was in 2009, when there were literally vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices, otherwise known as truck bombs, headed for the embassy in 2009. There are a lot of posts. I think that's a sign of the non-specificity of the intelligence. But what has really been lost sight of is that the degradation that Brian Jenkins spoke of, the degradation of Al-Qaeda capabilities, means that that catastrophic threat has really been reduced as a possibility, and the likelihood that Al Qaeda would be able to strike from abroad is much less than it used to be. I think the president got it exactly right in his speech in May at the National Defense University when he said the threat today is overseas. It's in the region. It's against official U.S. posts above all, and it's from homegrown extremists. And I really do think we're in a better place than we were before, but no one ever said that the threat had gone away.
Gregory Johnson, you are an expert on Yemen, and that's where the to the extent there's any specificity to this threat, it was from Yemen, and that is the affiliate that had been communicating with Zawahiri. Has the president and the administration gotten it exactly right on Yemen?
I don't think that they have. The U.S. has been carrying out drone and airstrikes in Yemen for much of the past 4 years, going back to December of 2009. And in that time, the U.S. has certainly had a number of successes. They've had times where on-the-ground intelligence came together with the great technology that the U.S. uses in order to take out very real terrorist threats, whether it be Anwar al-Awlaki, the American-born cleric who was killed in September 2011, whether it be AQAP's number two, a former Guantanamo Bay detainee who was killed earlier this year. But the U.S. has also made a lot of mistakes in Yemen. And the U.S. has killed some civilians. The numbers on these, the estimates on how many civilians are killed, varies a great deal depending on who it is that you ask. But what we've seen over the 4 years or nearly 4 years that the U.S. has been carrying out strikes within Yemen is that Al-Qaeda, in terms of numbers, has gone from about 200 or 300 from, say, Christmas Day 2009, when Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula was able to put the would-be underwear bomber on the plane bound from Detroit, all the way up up to, in the State Department or in John Brennan's estimate, at over 1,000 today. Now, numbers aren't the only sort of barometer to measure a group's strength, but I think it is worrying that the group seems to be attracting more members while the U.S. carries out more and more raids.
Ambassador Benjamin, big mistakes in Yemen?
I don't entirely agree with Gregory on this one. I think the overall strength of al-Qaeda in Yemen has probably diminished a bit over the last year or two, largely because of the strong counterterrorism determination of President Hadi, who, unlike his predecessor, has really taken the fight to AQAP. The numbers have changed because al-Qaeda during Yemen's sort of Arab Spring moment, when President Saleh was headed for the door and there was this very protracted transition going on, al-Qaeda seized an enormous amount of territory in Yemen. Again, a country that's never really been ruled from Sana'a and has a lot of ungoverned areas. Al-Qaeda seized a lot of territory and sort of like a snowball, acquired a number of recruits, most of whom were in it just to get a few dollars a day that they could live off. And so like a snowball, the thing sort of accretes. But it also melts down again. And we've seen this kind of trend over and over again in Yemen. There's no question that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is a dangerous group and that it's at its core, it has some very savvy technicians, bomb makers, and the like. But I wouldn't say that it is growing by leaps and bounds by any means. And I also think that it remains deeply unpopular in many parts of Yemen because of the instability it brings and the threat that it poses to people's security.
Brian Michael Jenkins, I want to get you to react to a message that we got from a listener on Facebook. Ethan Mertz writes, distraction. The NSA doesn't like the attention they're getting over the Snowden leaks, so it's, hey, look over there time. Is that a credible charge to make?
I don't believe so. I mean, certainly the issue of terrorism as it's portrayed by U.S. officials is always vulnerable to the allegation that the portrayal of the threat reflects domestic politics rather than actual threats. I don't think it is in the interest of any administration to over-portray the threat. That doesn't mean that everyone gets it right all the time. But I'm not inclined to see threats that are simply fabricated in order to distract people's attention from other issues.
Let's hear from one of our listeners. We've got Sean calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Sean, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Go ahead.
I wanted to make a statement. I personally have done three tours in Iraq, three tours in Afghanistan with the U.S. Army. And I think part of what the average everyday person doesn't realize is that while al-Qaeda is extremely decentralized now, they do, as your guests have said, rely very, very heavily on offshoots and as well as the homegrown fanatic. And one homegrown fanatic with several pounds of explosives can do a tremendous amount of damage. As well, I think a large majority of the reason for these embassy closures is that the Obama administration does not want a repeat of the Benghazi situation in which Chris Stevens and Glenn Doherty, a former Navy SEAL, as well as the other contractors, were killed by, you know, these rogue terrorists that kind of just collected themselves in a very brief period of time, and suddenly, before anyone knew it, the damage was done, and there were many accusations of, you know, obviously not enough was done in preparation, that they knew that the threat was coming, yet they did not react properly.
Sean, thanks so much for your call. Let me get a reaction from Ambassador Benjamin. Is it lessons of Benghazi being applied?
I'd put it this way. If you've lost one ambassador in very recent history, you're going to be particularly sensitive to the possibility of losing more diplomatic personnel. And you know, there's certainly a heightened desire to protect American personnel that always exists, but it's going to be even stronger after an experience like Benghazi. And frankly, you know, there's a recognition that our prestige and our ability to deter attacks declines if there are successful strikes carried out. So I think this is not a surprising reaction. At the same time, I wouldn't characterize it as an overreaction.
Gregory Johnson, on the caller's other point, the idea that a singular attacker can do tremendous damage, if Yemen, in fact, is such a breeding ground, why haven't we seen a proliferation of one-off attacks?
Right. So this is something that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula has obviously tried to do by dispatching the would-be suicide bomber who thankfully failed to detonate his bomb on the plane over Detroit. They've tried to send cartridge bombs in 2010. And then more recently in 2012, they developed a very advanced sort of an underwear bomb 2.0 that they handed over to an individual, thankfully, who was working for Western and Saudi intelligence in Yemen. And so their technical capabilities remain quite high with Ibrahim Asiri, the bomb maker, the Saudi national, who we've all heard a great deal about in the last few days. What they really lack are people who are able to sort of travel into the West. And this, I think, is something that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is searching for. And if I could just touch on something that Ambassador Benjamin said, I think he's absolutely correct in saying that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula remains unpopular in Yemen. But so does the United States. And I think in a war like this, it's the side that kills the most civilians that ends up losing. And this is something that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula has really internalized. And it doesn't appear, at least from the way that the U.S. is carrying out the strikes and from the way that the strikes are perceived on the ground, which is almost as important, perception and reality. It doesn't seem that the U.S. has internalized the same lessons. And so a lot of people are certainly frustrated with al-Qaeda, but many of them are much more frustrated with the U.S.
Ambassador Benjamin, is it a fact that the collateral damage from drone strikes has a more consequential effect than we've appreciated?
I would not say that the collateral effect is greater than we've appreciated. We've appreciated it all along. I think the president spoke to this in his speech, and it's something that we're all of us who have been involved in government counterterrorism policy are acutely aware of. We weigh these things very, very carefully to ensure that the net effect is positive in terms of diminishing the imminent threat, but also the longer term strategic threat. And I would just, you know, say that Gregory Johnson and I are going to have to agree to disagree on this. I think that we've looked at it pretty carefully and on a national basis in Yemen. There's no question that the loss of the loss of life is hugely regrettable and tragic. But we think the overall trend still is in the right direction, and I think that's reflected in Yemen's leadership and in its strengthening resolve against al-Qaeda.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the embassy closings and the al-Qaeda threat now. We're joined this hour by Brian Michael Jenkins, terrorism expert at the RAND Corporation. Also by Ambassador Daniel Benjamin, former State Department counterterrorism official and director of the Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth. And by Gregory Johnson, author of The Last Refuge, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's War in Arabia. Ambassador Benjamin, I want to start by this segment by going back to a foundational idea and getting you to assess it for us, because many Americans may be confused right now. How important a milestone was it to get Osama bin Laden after all?
Well, it was very important. As long as bin Laden was out there, al-Qaeda appeared to have a kind of divine wind at its back and suggested that it could – and it implied that it could really defy the United States and the West, you know, forever. And so there was an important symbolic component, but there was also an important operational component. We found out that he was still more involved in setting strategy for the group and directing its overall operations than we had imagined. So it removed this charismatic leader who was at the head of an organization who had been out there for a long time, a lot longer than I think most people, not only in America but around the world, thought he should have been. And, you know, it had a practical effect as well. So it was important, but I don't think anyone ever characterized that as being you know, the end of the story. It simply wasn't, and it would have been a mistake to think it would have been.
Brian, one of our listeners on Facebook, Janice Delaney Stearns, sent this message. Ayman al-Zawahiri and Mullah Omar are just as dangerous, if not more so, than bin Laden. We need to send the SEALs after these two co-conspirators. Zawahiri was always the power behind the throne. Why has he been forgotten? Does she have a point?
I don't know that he has been forgotten at all. I'm certain that he continues to be a target of American efforts. I think the ambassador got it exactly right on bin Laden. It was a loss of a charismatic figure. But it was interesting that when Zawahiri took over, Zawahiri, although a strategist, certainly did not possess the charisma of bin Laden. In terms of his communications, he communicated more like a political commissar than an inspirational leader. But yet, Zawahiri has been able, and here the source of the message that you just mentioned does have it right. He has been able to consolidate his authority over the organization. He is still issuing orders. He is a strategist, and one would have to judge by the trajectory of al-Qaeda since the beginning of the Arab uprising and look at his communications and to say that they have skillfully exploited both the uprisings. By the way, the al-Qaeda claims credit for having actually set in motion the events that led to the Arab uprisings with their attack on 9/11. Now, that's an extravagant claim, but it's a claim they make. But they have been able to skillfully not only exploit the uprisings, but to prepare to exploit the disillusion, the disappointment, and indeed some of the conflicts that we see arising now in Egypt in the wake of the initial uprisings.
Gregory Johnson, let me ask you about what Brian just called the extravagant claim that the attack on 9/11 set in motion the events that led to the Arab uprising. Does that have any plausibility?
Yeah, I think Brian's exactly right on this. You know, al-Qaeda has been able to take advantage of some of the breakdown in security that's taken place from the Arab uprisings. But I think it's a stretch and, as he said, an extravagant claim to talk about them sort of putting this in motion. I did want to mention that I think when we're talking about this sort of broader issue of how it is that the U.S. fights this war and how the U.S. is combating al-Qaeda, going from the death of Osama bin Laden, looking for Ayman al-Zawahiri, combating the affiliate in Yemen, I think there's a fundamental flaw in the way that the U.S. is approaching this. And that is, I believe there to be a very real but unspoken assumption in Washington that the U.S. believes that this is a war that it can win on its own. And I think that's a mistake. I think in a place like Yemen, it's only the tribesmen and it's only the clerics who are in the position to sort of lead definitively disrupt, dismantle, and defeat al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And if you'll just forgive me one quick story, there was a moment in 2012 in which a preacher in Yemen out in Hadramut, which is in the far eastern region of Yemen, and he was doing exactly what I suggested is necessary. He was getting up every Friday, giving anti-al-Qaeda speeches saying al-Qaeda has no place within Islam. These people are murderers. They're criminals. And in fact, he was doing such a good job. And his sermons were having such an impact that all local al-Qaeda members called a meeting with him in order to try to get him to tone down his rhetoric. Now, somehow the U.S. found out about that meeting, and they fired a drone at that meeting. Three al-Qaeda members were killed, but the anti-al-Qaeda cleric was killed as well. And since then, we haven't heard a lot of stories about clerics and tribesmen standing up and really taking the fight to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And I think that's a real problem for the U.S. moving forward.
Let's take a call from one of our listeners. We have Jamie from Sumter, South Carolina. Jamie, welcome to On Point.
Hi. Hi. I just wanted to say that I think that everyone needs to remember the Trojan horse. And I think that you can never be too cautious. And I don't think being cautious is being weak. It's being smart. And I think that if you can save one life, and they're more than just ambassadors. They're human beings. And so if you can save their life by closing down and doing what you need to do, then that's what you need to do. And I also wanted to say this. I am a spouse of a soldier, and I feel like if it's these soldiers, they are willing to risk their life. My husband, he always says this is his job, this is what he has to do. But if you have the technology such as drones to help these soldiers fight another day, so be it.
Ambassador Benjamin, what about Jamie's point on the use of drones in particular, which has gotten a significant amount of criticism from some on the left, some on the right?
Well, it has certainly aroused a lot of discussion. I guess the point I would want to make is that U.S. strategy is not focused solely on unilateral measures, and this goes to what Gregory Johnson was talking about. A huge part of our effort involves working with partner governments and training up their forces so that they can do the job in their country in a way that they know will be more effective than our coming in from the outside. One of the real downsides of drawing down at the embassy in Sana'a is that a lot of military personnel will have to leave as well, and that reduces our ability to train and equip Yemeni forces in the way that the Yemeni authorities would like us to, and that's a huge loss. But we are doing work like that around the world, and I think in Washington there's an acute understanding that this is ultimately the road to reducing the al-Qaeda threat. On the issue of, you know, working with tribes and all, you know, Gregory Johnson makes an important point that a lot of the progress will come through those sort of regional or sub-regional powers. The U.S. has found through hard experience over many years that it should deal with Sana'a and let Sana'a deal with the tribes, because tribal politics, as they are, for example, in Somalia, are incredibly complex, and you can achieve exactly the opposite of what you intended by getting too deeply involved in them. But I do think that listeners really should understand that a very, very big emphasis of U.S. policy is to train other governments. When I was at the State Department, we made a particular emphasis on building rule of law institutions, especially in Arab Spring countries, which have gone from authoritarianism to, we hope, more representative institutions. And we created an international organization with 30 members, 30 other countries in the EU, specifically to build what we call the capacity building agenda. And there's going to be a new center in Tunis to train regional officials in how to combat terrorism. And there's also a new center of excellence in Abu Dhabi that works on another thing that Gregory Johnson was talking about, which is the ideological piece of this, and to help individuals, governments, NGOs, civil society, and the like combat or counter violent extremism. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot else going on aside from drone strikes.
Fair enough. A lot else going on. Let's go to another listener. We've got Travis from Pine Island, Minnesota. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. My question is, I was wondering, if al-Qaeda is such a threat nowadays, then why is it that we are aiding and giving the ammo and guns to the Syrian rebels, which have been linked to the Al-Qaeda in Syria.
Thanks for that question, Travis. Gregory Johnson, is that a mistake?
That's something that I think both Brian and Ambassador Benjamin are in a much better position to speak to than I am. I focus pretty exclusively on Yemen, and so I wouldn't want to talk about something that I don't know particularly well.
Brian?
Well, the difficulty in arming the rebels, I mean, the administration has been under great pressure to provide greater assistance to the rebels confronting Assad. But the rebels are not a monolith. There's not a rebel organization. There's a plethora of rebel units that are there, many of them subscribing to Al-Qaeda ideology. Some of them sincerely so, others because they simply think it is an easier path to obtaining support from other parts of the Middle East in the absence of support from the West. Now, how one enters that very complex conflict going on in Syria right now and ensures that any military equipment that the United States provides or any military support goes to the right parties and doesn't end up in the hands of Al-Qaeda ideologues who will in turn use it against us is extremely complicated. And I think the United States was reluctant initially, then decided it would go ahead and provide greater assistance to the rebels. And then actually once it came down to operationalizing that, that has turned out to be a bit more complicated than many people have imagined.
Brian, let me ask you to give us a little technological update. When you think to how the world of technology has changed since the 9/11 attacks, how has the technological capacity of terrorists to hit us and hurt us changed?
Well, the technology of terrorism continues to move incrementally. That is, there are talented bomb makers that can make devices that are increasingly difficult to detect without the most intrusive searches. But terrorism really isn't about technology. The objective of terrorism is terror, and the terrorist planners know that they cannot match America's technological superiority. They cannot defeat us in open battle, and so instead their form of warfare is really a form of psychological warfare. They believe that they can, with terrorist attacks, with terrorist plots, with rumors of terrorist plots, wear us down, create alarm, force us to divert vast resources to security, and in a sense make our lives untenable to the point that we will, wearied and bloodied, withdraw from the entire Middle East as the Soviets were ultimately obliged to withdraw from Afghanistan.
Gregory Johnson, let me shift gears from the technological question and ask what you expect over, say, the next 3 to 6 months in Yemen, given the situation we find ourselves in right now.
Right. So there are a couple of things. We've seen over the past 2 weeks, we've seen 5 drone strikes, which is a rapid increase. For some time, particularly after President Obama's speech in May, the U.S. had really held its fire. And now we're seeing more and more drone strikes, presumably because they're linked to this plot. And that, I think, raises a couple of issues for me. One, I'm very concerned about what's taking place in Yemen over this next 3 to 6 months, the short term that you talk about, as well as the long term. The current leadership of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the men we're afraid of today, people like Nasr al-Wahhashi, their worldview was formed in the late 1990s. The worldview of tomorrow's terrorists is being formed today in an environment that is much, much more radical than what we saw in the late 1990s. And I think a frustration that I and I believe many in Washington share as well is that the U.S. has more money. It has more men. It has better technology. It has better weapons. And it's self-evidently on the right side of this conflict. And yet in a country like Yemen, it appears that we're losing on the ground. And that's a deep source of frustration and something I'm greatly worried about.
Ambassador Benjamin, as we leave, let me just ask you to give our listeners a sense of expectation. Is the kind of threat and response that we've seen in the last week or so something that we should get used to, or is it likely to be not repeated anytime soon?
Well, I certainly hope it's not repeated on this scale, but I do think that we're going to see plenty of embassy openings and closings in particular, temporary drawdowns, because a consequence of the Arab Spring is that internal security forces are weaker than they were. Now, over the long term, I hope this will be a good thing, and we'll have stronger countries, stronger democracies in this region. But right now, the new normal is that it's hard to protect American posts and American interests abroad. So I think we are going to see more of this.
Ambassador Daniel Benjamin, thanks so much. Brian Michael Jenkins from the RAND Corporation, thanks to you as well. And Gregory Johnson, thanks, the author of Last Refuge, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's War in Arabia. Coming up tomorrow, with no charges of wrongdoing, you can lose your car and your house from asset forfeiture laws. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.